You're listening to On the Record Online with Eric Schwartzman, where reporters and journalists go on the record about how they use the internet to cover the news. For the latest trends, tips, and tactics on how the web shapes popular opinion, subscribe to our RSS news feed or visit us online at www.ipressroom.com.
Journalist, broadcast journalist, author, and host of the most downloaded podcast in the world, Leo Laporte goes on the record.
What's least useful to me is a website that describes it in marketing terms. I mean, obviously that's what you want to put as your face to the outside world. But if you have a press section, that press section should have white papers, should have factual material. I always want to know, well, how do you do it? And that gives me the chance to report to my audience, more clearly what's going on behind the scenes here. That's what I want to know.
We'll be back. Stay with us.
Don't be left behind. Get the latest online PR tools and services from iPressroom. Powerful, easy to use, available on demand. Extend your sphere of influence online with iPressroom. Tools for online media centers, virtual private press rooms, RSS news feeds, podcasts, and more at www.ipressroom.com. iPressroom, always on, even when you're off.
So now, the first question I want to ask you, Leo, is how does a guy with a degree in Chinese history from Yale wind up hosting the most downloaded podcast in the world?
What a long, strange trip it's been. The Chinese was just something that I had to pick a major. I love history, so I just had to pick that. But, you know, I also worked in the campus radio station, and frankly, that became my one true love. And I don't have a degree. I never did graduate. I dropped out in my junior year, foregoing my great future in Chinese studies for a future in broadcasting. And then, you know, I've been a broadcaster for almost 30 years. It'll be 30 years next year. So this is just, you know, in fact, it's interesting. The podcasting is just a return to the power of the medium that I started in. I mean, I think radio is a great medium, and now it's back, baby.
Do you ever talk about Chinese history on This Week in Tech?
No. Although I think it's good that I have a background in history, because I think that has been, you know, useful. I always tell people when they say, what should I major in college? I say, whatever you do, don't major in broadcasting. That's about the worst major you could pick. Pick something that'll give you a broader sense of, you know, life. You know, pick a liberal arts major and take that to your broadcast career. I think the best broadcasters are people who never studied broadcasting.
It's an interesting point of view. I don't remember who it was, but I was watching Charlie Rose, and maybe it was the dean of the School of Business who was interviewed as he was on his way out from Harvard School of Business, mm-hmm. on Charlie Rose. And he was saying, you know, you don't take classes in college, you take teachers.
Well, that's true too. Yeah, absolutely. But I'm an old timer. I believe in the whole notion of a liberal arts degree, a person having a broad and varied interests and knowledge. And I think that's especially important for a journalist. Even if you're a beat journalist like I am, focusing on trade, it's very, very valuable to have, you know, the knowledge of stuff that's, you know, of other stuff. And I think the more you know, the better.
Well, let's talk about that. You know, what you said, you know, you are a journalist. Obviously, you have a tremendous amount of perspective, having written for traditional print outlets, having had success as a broadcaster both in TV and in radio, and now over into podcasting with the number one most downloaded podcast in the world. How do you choose the topics for TWiT?
Well, we don't really. I mean, the way it works, first of all, you know, TWiT is a bunch of other high-powered journalists. It's like herding cats. You can't very well tell them what direction you're going to take the podcast in. Even if you had a plan, it would change. So generally the way it works is on Friday I will kind of futilely set out an email to everybody saying, okay, we're recording Sunday, 2:30. Here are the stories that are the top stories this week, or the stories I think would be of interest to cover this week. And I get those from, I do a lot of news checking anyway, beat checking through the main, you know, Google News and Wired News and CNET and PC Mag and all of those places, dig slash dot, looking for stories not only of real importance, you know, like the Mac Intel decision, but also stories that would give us something of interest to debate or to talk about. So a lot of times it may not be the biggest story of the week. But anyway, I'll pitch 10, 15 stories. They'll come back with 10 or 1 or 5 of, you know, that they want to cover. And we don't agree on anything. We tried for a while having a rundown, and that was useless. So we just circulate that. And it gives them an idea of the kinds of things. But they know by now what we like to talk about. And really, it's just whatever it is that captures our interest or our fancy. And a lot of times, if you listen to Twit, it's pretty obvious we're meandering all over the place. It's not a traditional broadcast by any means.
But with respect to the wires and the mainstream media outlets that you track to decide what to talk about for the show, how does consumer-generated media, and how does the blogosphere impact the decisions you make about what to talk about?
I don't look or care about what other people are covering so much. We just talk about, you know, that's the nice thing about Twitter. It's not a formal news service. We're not on formal media, and we don't have any mandate from anybody to do anything. So, you know, we all read all of those things, I guess, or maybe some of us don't. I don't know. We're kind of, you know, really the whole idea behind Twit was I missed the experience I had at Tech TV, and anybody has if they're working in trade press, of being around colleagues who are covering these stories all the time. And the ability to kind of sit around and BS with them about what's interesting, what's hot, what's surprising, what's the story behind the story. And I missed that. That was really good background for me in doing my work. And so I said, well, we should just do this. We should get together once in a while. I didn't think about recording it. We should just get together once in a while and talk because I miss you guys. And we did at Macworld Expo, and I happened to have a recorder, and I recorded some of it, and the response was very good. So we decided, well, let's kill two birds with one stone. We want to do this anyway. Let's record it. So it's not. So you understand, it's not like it's a show. We don't have a mandate. We just do what we want to do.
Well, now that there are so many listeners of this show, I mean, you're listed on iTunes as the number one most listened to podcast.
For what that's worth, I don't, you know, how valuable that is.
Well, certainly there has been some speculation that there's a way to goose those numbers.
But we know that for a fact. So I have no idea if those numbers are valid, if it's an overzealous Twit army doing that, or if they're actual subscribers. I know we have, you know, I know we probably have, we have at least 120,000 downloads per show. I know that from the hard download numbers from AOL, and that's just one of many ways to get it. So, you know, I know we probably at least 150,000 to 200,000 listeners, but... all those rankings, you know, podcasts, all that stuff is just, we're in our infancy. Who knows who the big shows are? However, well, I digress because I know that wasn't your main point. I did want to address that because there's a lot of attention paid to rankings, and we pay a lot of attention to rankings. We're often criticized by our audience for talking about it, and really, we're not talking about it to crow. We're talking about it to marvel. we're as surprised as anybody that we're anywhere near the top of those rankings. So,
what do you think the size of the overall podcast listening audience is today?
Well, remember, right now it's still enthusiasts, it's early adopters, it's technologists, it's people who have, and that's why the technology podcasts do well. You know, I have no illusions that my podcasts will still be at the top of the charts in a year. Right now, it's very, very early adopters, but down the road, I think, you know, you're going to see all kinds of different podcasts, and I think you're going to see a huge, potentially huge audience, potentially, I think, as big as the broadcast radio audience. It's got to be a little easier to use, and it's got to be more widespread. But remember, broadband penetration is now close to 60%. Most people have computers. A great many people have portable MP3 players. I think music radio is starting to feel the pinch from music in the car from your MP3 player, and I think talk radio is about to feel that pinch from podcasts. So right now, it's somewhere, who knows, I may not be making a wild guess, 1 million, 2 million, I don't know. Down the road, it could be 50 million. I mean, I think the upside is very, very good.
Do you think there's an argument that could be made that podcast listeners are somehow more influential than non-podcast listeners?
Yeah, they are in technology for sure. They're the influencers. They're the early adopters and influencers. There's no question about that. And I think that's one of the reasons podcasting is going to grow fast. These are the people their friends and family say, well, what's this thing, podcasting? Yeah. They see it in iTunes. Well, first of all, they turned on their friends and family to iTunes and an iPod. And now their friends and family are looking, what's this podcast thing on the iTunes thing there? What is that? And they look at, you know, if you click on that, I think a lot of people don't, by the way. I've mentioned the fact that iTunes supports podcasting to a number of people who've been very surprised. They said, well, where's that? How do you get there? I said, well, just look on the left. It says podcasts. A lot of people don't click that link anymore. They click the audiobooks link. But once they click it, they look at it, they go, wow, look at the variety, the range of mainstream and consumer media on here. This is interesting. And I think that the people who are listening now very much will influence people in podcasts. They tell people what kind of computers. In technology, yes, they're influencers. Are they culturally influencers? Only to the degree that technology is important in our culture.
What opportunity, if any, do you think podcasting represents to organizations?
I think it's very important. I think organizations have got to realize that we live in a new world. You know, when I was working for Tech TV, I bought 20 copies of the Clue Train Manifesto and gave it to all the executives, hoping they'd get a clue. They didn't. But I still think it's worth reading, cluetrain.org. The point of it is that consumers are empowered now by the internet. They can, you know, product loyalty is dissipating. We're in a friction-free marketplace. People can go somewhere else. They can get a better price. They can go to your competitor, even if he's in Istanbul instead of New York City. And in order to compete in an environment like that, you've got to have a conversation with your audience. It's got to be a two-way street. That's not just true of media, although it's very important for media. You know, we're used to sitting in our big thrones and talking down to people. That's got to change, but every business has to change. And podcasting is one of the ways that people can reach out to their customers and talk to them as real people. Now, I think that that's an opportunity a lot of corporations will miss because they're deathly afraid of actually relating to their customers. But smart corporations will say, oh, here's an opportunity to really speak to them, to create allegiances, to create product loyalty, brand loyalty, to create a relationship with our customer that goes far beyond anything we could do before. And that's a really great opportunity.
Now, how, in your estimation, or maybe you even have experiences with this now, is podcasting impacting the rules of media relations?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I think the internet has already. I'll give you an example. You know, on Twit, we were talking about Plaxo, which is a corporate address, you know, internet address books company, and I was, you know, bitching about it, and I even, you know, put in the show notes something like, "We hate Plaxo." And Plaxo's smart enough to be searching the internet all the time for mentions, and they found it, and they immediately contacted me and had their PR person, but also their founder contact me to have a conversation with me to try to change my mind about it. And I think that was very savvy. So I think, yes, your media relations have changed a lot just because you can, you used to have to pay a clipping service. I think you certainly still should, but you also should be doing an internet clipping service, which is actually much easier to do. You probably could do it yourself, and pay attention to what other people are saying, particularly bloggers and podcasters, and respond to it. Be proactive. And I think that you can do yourself a lot of good by talking to these guys. I think that very much has changed. If you buy the notion, at least in technology, if you buy the notion that the bloggers and the podcasters are influencers and that their audience are influencers, it's very important that you pay attention to them. You know, yeah, sure, Walt Mossberg carries a lot more weight. But in a way, somebody who has a personal relationship with 10,000 listeners, somebody who's trusted by those 10,000 listeners, that person can carry a lot of weight. You know, I hear all the time people who are on my show and then on major mainstream media who get very little response from the mainstream media, but will get a huge amount of response from my much smaller TV or radio shows. And that's because it's a targeted audience and an audience that trusts me and responds, I think, at a much higher rate than the mainstream media audience. You know, when I do Regis and Kelly and talk about products, I often barely move the needle. in terms of response to me, and I imagine in terms of response to those products. But if I do it on my podcast or on my radio or TV show, we can see huge jumps in web traffic and product sales.
When Apple released 4.9, Adam Curry was critical of Audible's ability to sell product over iTunes, because now they would have newfound competition from all these talk programs via podcasts, which are free. And what the folks at Audible did, and I don't know if this was Don Katz himself or their PR team, but rather than respond with a comment or a phone call from the PR team, they actually emailed over an audio comment from Don Katz responding to Adam Curry.
That's pretty smart.
Anything like that ever happened with you?
No, not yet. I think that, first of all, Adam is doing stuff for Apple and iTunes, so he's, you should consider the source. I think Audible's very well positioned to benefit from this. Audible's been benefiting from it all along. Audible's been the very, a secret dark horse in all of this. They've been doing this by, for paid version for a couple of years. I've been an Audible subscriber for years and loving it. So they're early on the curve. I don't think that they're going to be hurt by this at all. I just think that it'll actually teach a lot more people to listen to audio on their MP3 players, and when it's time for them to listen to a book that they can't get as a podcast for free, they'll go to Audible. I think the way of responding is interesting. Yeah, I mean, if somebody sent me something like that on Twitter, I don't play stuff on Twitter. So Adam does. So it makes more sense to do it to Adam. I don't just randomly play cuts from people on Twitter.
I interviewed John Markoff of the New York Times recently, and he said he thinks you get to a million-channel universe by just connecting things like BitTorrent and RSS.
That's right.
And so my question is, what do you think the impact, ultimately, of RSS on conventional broadcast will be?
Well, it's like saying, what's the impact of HTTP? I mean, RSS is just a protocol, which I don't think is... I think that's the wrong place to look. The better question is, and maybe there'll be a better protocol. I mean, for one thing, RSS is hard to use still. I mean, that's a low layer. I would be more interested in what the higher layer is going to look like, the directories, the ways people have of subscribing. Tim Berners-Lee said, I never intended anybody to see http://. That should never been exposed. RSS should not be exposed either. Nobody should have to enter in a URL.
Well, but the practical challenges aside, the idea that an infrastructure has sprung up that allows pretty much anybody to distribute electronic media or text via the internet for free. I mean,
but that's what the computer revolution is all about. From the day one, one of the biggest benefits of digital technology is that it's cheap or free to create content, cheap or free to distribute content. It puts the power of the press in the hand of the people. And that started with day one with web pages, then blogs, then podcasting. It's going to happen any day now with video. That is the revolution. It's not RSS or BitTorrent. Those are specifics, but the revolution is that the digitization of content makes it easy to create and modify content. And the existence of the internet makes it easy to distribute.
How in the world are terrestrial broadcasters going to adapt?
Well, they're gone. They're history. They don't make any sense in this world. It's over. In fact, when we were starting a cable channel, I really questioned the wisdom of building what was essentially a brick-and-mortar business in a world where 10, 20 years out, it was going to be IPTV. I think that the traditional media are in much deeper trouble than they realize.
Now, you've published a guide to TiVo, but what tips do you have for TiVo users about avoiding spoilers?
What do you mean by spoilers? You mean...
Well, I mean, the critics, the television...
Oh, I see.
And,
because
and movie
you're,
critics
oh, I get
have
it.
Figured out
well,
a way...
critics are going to have to avoid spoiling. I mean, they got to realize people aren't watching stuff live anymore. TiVo has been a significant shift in the way people consume media that is much more important than the penetration of TiVo would indicate. People have shifted from the notion of you got to watch it when it's on to you get to watch it when you want to watch it, wherever you want to watch it. That's what consumers want. That's what the digital revolution has promised them. And any critic who dares to spoil things is going to stop being read pretty darn quick.
Well, the critics have figured it out. I mean, they understand how to review a movie without giving away the end. But now we've got all this interactive media in our face everywhere. I've got flat screen panels in the elevator at my work. They're running
right.
a feed of sports photos from Getty Images.
Right.
And I just want to get home and watch my U.S. Open TiVo without knowing who the winner is.
Well, people better learn because you know what? There's going to be a backlash. I mean, you're absolutely right. People had better learn. They can't do that. There'll be a backlash. People start defacing those screens. People are going to get what they want, and it's very clear that what people want is to watch things when at their convenience, and they don't want to have it be spoiled. You know, I don't read movie reviews for that reason. I talk to a lot of people who say, in fact, I think it's pretty common wisdom these days is that you don't want to read a movie review. You don't want to. It's always better to see the movie with find out if it's good or not, and we have all sorts of ways to do that without having to read a spoiler. It's not merely the spoiler, it's just the reading a review, whether it tells you the secrets of the movie or just tells you about the movie, spoils it. I mean, The Matrix was so much more powerful because I saw it before I knew what it was about. And I think people want that experience.
I would argue that in any major metro, you are surrounded by so much media everywhere you go that it's almost impossible not to know what's happened.
Maybe, yeah. I think that that's probably true, but I think that that's going to look. I've disconnected my cable. I don't watch TV anymore, and I think I'm a forerunner of where media is going. I think people want much more control over what they see, and in the long run, that's where it's headed.
The Newswires actually released the American Idol winner on East Coast time, which right. obviously spoiled the season finale for West Coast viewers.
Well, you're asking the wrong guy.
Any suggestions on how the Wires, need to adapt?
I don't think American Idol speaks to the same group that you're talking about, frankly. I think I'm not too worried about that. I don't watch it.
But there were people in my office who were furious.
Yeah, well, be interesting to see what happens. I think that there will be a consequence to that kind of behavior. Advertisers have that issue coming. They're facing that issue because, of course, nobody's watching their ads anymore. So their response to that has become more aggressive. That's exactly, of course, the wrong response. And in the long run, the consumer's going to win any of these battles. There's far more of them than there are of advertisers or media. Any media outlet that thinks it knows best or knows better than consumers is going to have a rude surprise.
So now, because you can't really watch sports enjoyably if you know who the winner was. I mean, do you think sports programming is somehow impervious to losing advertisers? Is this like the one type of content that will have to be broadcast live?
Yeah, that makes sense. I imagine event programming like American Idol, sports, the Academy Awards, I guess. You know, you're asking the wrong guy. I don't watch that crap. I have no interest in it at all. So I can't really tell you. I don't know. Yeah, it would make sense to me. I gave up on the network and broadcast television a long time ago.
Let's flip over to the other side, to the PR side if we can for a minute. I'd be interested to hear your perspective on this. But sometimes we will release news for clients under an embargo, and I'm sure you've received
no.
news.
Yeah, I ignore embargoes and NDAs. I don't deal with them.
So, for example, when Real Networks or iPod or one of these big releases comes out and they want everyone to have a fair crack at covering the news at the same time, you typically won't participate.
No, I never do because I have no lead times. An embargo or an NDA makes sense for those media that have lead times. I'm in broadcast media. I don't have a lead time. Plus, I have a lousy memory. So it's impossible for me to remember what's embargoed and what's not, what's NDA'd and what's not. So I refuse to participate in those. And I think most good journalists are moving in that direction. I think that that doesn't make sense. In this
I mean, we see, obviously, government agencies releasing reports, the Fed releasing reports that are under embargo until midnight a certain time so as not to give anyone an unfair advantage over it. And I wonder, do you think that needs to just disappear?
I think it will. Because I think you have more and more journalists who don't, non-journalists who won't adhere to an embargo, and more real journalists who don't. And we live in an immediate day and age. I see no good reason to participate in that. And, I don't look at embargoed stuff and I don't look at NDAs. I'm not trying to, scoop anybody. I just refuse to participate in it, but there are plenty of people probably who will violate their embargoes and NDAs, as we get more and more, you know, kind of non-trained journalists in this area. And besides, that comes from an era when you had a three-month lead time in a magazine. That era is gone. We're in the day of instantaneous coverage.
Well, certainly at the monthlies, I mean, there still is a 90-day lead time for feature coverage.
Yeah, why do you think monthlies, at least in my business and technology, why do you think they're dying?
And typically what we see is the monthlies looking for the evergreens.
They've got to find something else. Yeah, I mean, if I want to know what's new in technology, do I read PC Magazine or do I go on the internet?
You know, I'm still impressed by Wired Magazine's ability to digest and make relevant technology.
And that makes sense. If you've got a three-month lead time, then you'd better be doing analysis, not news coverage. I mean, that just makes a lot of sense. And I think that means that people who understand this are going to be valued more and more. People who, you know, we always said that editorial function become more important, although I have to say that even that is being shaken by these social sites like Dig, where there is no editorial function. The editorial function is performed by the readers, and I think it does a pretty good job. I mean, there are flaws in it, but I think even that notion that we had that, oh yeah, somebody's going to make sense of all of this, may have been a little misguided. I do think that people who can write thoughtful analysis and think pieces will be valued, and we'll certainly see the light of day in print.
I noticed.
I wonder how long magazines are going to be around. You know.
I noticed on Technorati, Katrina is the number one most searched term. Do you think ultimately the blogosphere is going to sink the AP?
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. I think the question is how long before it sinks CNN? Right now, if you want to see coverage of Katrina, there are a few times where I regret not having a television, a cable. And this is when there's an event with pictures like this, this is one of those times. And right now, CNN still has ascendancy because it can bring live pictures. But how long before you can do that on the internet? I don't think that's too far off either. And I think citizen journalism and so forth. You know, I'm not a good predictor of what's going to happen. I mean, I just see this tidal wave coming, and I don't know what the long shot result will be. But anybody who thinks it's business as usual over the next decade is going to be sorely surprised.
There's also a photo feed, obviously still photos, from Flickr coming through on Technorati.
Right. Flickr's amazing.
Amazing photos of the damage.
Yeah, although Flickr may be in trouble because Yahoo's corporatizing it. This is something people have to be very aware of, that you've got to be careful, at least when you're dealing with these early influencers, early adopter techno geeks. They're very anti-corporate. And Yahoo may have stumbled by requiring them to create Yahoo accounts on Flickr to continue to use Flickr. I think that you know, people aren't particularly loyal in this day and age, and there's plenty of places they could go.
Well,
Yahoo's
got to
watch
point.
That carefully.
What I'm most interested to know is, obviously, there are a lot of proponents of open source solutions, and an equal, if not more, number of corporations looking to make a profit off these new technologies.
Right.
Who do you think is going to win out? I mean, do you think, we saw Apple put its stamp on RSS in terms of the schema that they're running through iTunes.
To the great annoyance of everybody, myself included, who podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, you had to run your feed through a validator and get it to work. And obviously, Dave Weiner was up in arms about it. I mean, do you think open source is the future, or do you think that...
Oh, I've always thought that. I mean, I think there's no question about it. I'm going to cop out on your question and say the consumers are the people who are going to win. I don't think it's a horse race. It's hard for me to pick a winner in the horse race, but I do think in the long run that consumers will win, and I do believe in open source. Look, we're building an infrastructure, and it's going to take a lot of capital. It is not a free infrastructure. So there's certainly room for capital, and there's certainly room for commercial entities in this. And in fact, more than room, we need them desperately. But I think there also is a lot to be said for open source, the open source model. The problem is it has to sit on top of this commercial infrastructure. And how do you have the one without losing the other? I don't know. But I think it's working out right now. I mean, I think if you Now, this will be interesting to watch this Flickr to Yahoo transition. This could be a bellwether for how easy it's going to be to take these kind of quirky personal things and make them corporate, and without losing an audience.
Back to TiVo for a second, because you're an expert in that. Don't you think that why is it that a service and a product that is so sensational, that is so revolutionary, has been so unsuccessful economically?
Well, I mean, this is an example of what I've kind of trying to been hinting at all along here, which is there is this thin layer of the techno savvy, the geeks, on top of a much larger layer of the techno ignorant. And TiVo is perceived by the vast marketplace as being far too complicated. And people didn't want the complexity. Now, I do believe that in the long run, what people want is the ability to watch media when they want it, where they want it. That is kind of a fundamental driving force from consumers, and in time that will become the way things are. But you've got these early adopters who are really bellwethers in this, and then the mass market, which we can't forget. I mean, that really is, 90% of the audience just isn't that savvy, and they're not interested in having a remote control with 300 buttons and figuring out how to season pass something and all that. So I think that's really what happened to us. Yeah, people who use TiVo love it, and they're all geeks. And the rest of the world said, I could barely program my VCR. Their perception was it's more complicated than the VCR. Of course it's not. But
so what you're saying is this is a communications challenge.
Yeah, it is. TiVo, TiVo was first mover in this space. And, there's this kind of thought that the first mover has an advantage. I don't think so. I think almost always you see that the first mover is the one at disadvantage. You look at the Apple Newton, and then you look at Palm. You look at, a lot of these technologies took a while to get traction. And I think TiVo is a good example. I have no doubt that the digital video recorder is the future, or video on demand, or some form of putting our media where we want it, when we want it, is the key. But TiVo might have been too early on the curve.
Have you checked out the new Slingbox?
Yeah, I love Sling. I've loved these for a long time. And this is another example of this stuff's been around for 5 years. We've been covering on the screensavers for ages. It's now starting to spread. And of course, it took the critical mass of people with their music on a computer and their stereo in the living room to get this to be a product. It's been around for a while. I love these things, and I think that more and more people are asking me about them. That's another big thorny issue. It gets right down to, though, that fundamental premise I mentioned, which is consumers want their content when they want it, where they want it. They don't want any restrictions on it. They want it to move around freely. You're seeing that time and time again in technology, and the Slingbox is an exact example of that, where it pains them that they've got these songs on the computer and their stereo in the living room. They can't, that's not right. Everything should just flow. And so products along that line, I think, are going to do very well. That's a good category to be in right now.
Leo, what words of wisdom do you have for PR people who want to get information to you?
To me, is a bad example, because I don't really like to talk to PR people, but as they well know. Although I think that the Plaxo example is a really good example of being proactive and responsive, I think the paradigm has really changed. I mean, you're not there sitting there as an intermediary between a product and kind of this monolithic media, the 20 magazines or the newspaper, whoever it is that you feel like you have to be in touch with. It's much more complex than that. Really what you're doing in marketing and PR nowadays is crafting image, and it has to be much more savvy than just making a phone call. It has to be, just as companies have to have relationships with their customers, no longer just selling to them. I think PR people have to support media in new and different ways. I'm probably the wrong person to ask, because I'm kind of cranky when it comes to media. I learned from John C. Dvorak, and And he taught me not to deal with the PR people. I love PR people and have many good friends in PR, but a lot of times they're more of a problem than a solution for me. I guess, you know, if I could say the perfect PR person would be the one who gets me the information when I want it and then leaves me alone. But I know you need to do more than that. You need to be more proactive than that.
Well, what if that PR information was somehow available on demand? I mean, would that...
Well, it is. That's called the internet. And that's part of the problem is there's this disintermediation. Look what's happened to Comdex. I don't need to go to Comdex to get this kind of information. It's all on the internet now. Just as magazines have been dying thanks to the internet, I think that the trade shows and PR are changing drastically. So the best thing a PR person can do is for me anyway, is give me access to people in the company who really know. I don't need the stuff I can read on the internet. So a press release doesn't help me particularly. Now, mainstream media, that may be true. Speaking for myself and the trade press, I guess, I think you know, the advanced trade press has a pretty good idea of what's going on. What we want is access.
How does the information that you might find on a corporate website impact your perception of that company?
Well, I certainly look for honesty, integrity, as little spin as possible. I think one of the reasons open source has succeeded is because they don't look like they're selling something. They just are straightforward. The beauty about the technology industry is that that's the instinct of engineers in general. Engineers just want to tell you the truth. They're very black and white, concrete folks, and they make, from my point of view, the best interviews, the best sources, because there's no spin there. They give me the facts. They give me the story, and that's really what I'm most interested in.
Do you have certain expectations of what you should be able to find at a company's website?
I mean, the more the better. The more information, the better. That's key. And I'm particularly always interested. I think there's a certain amount of hiding and patronizing going on a lot of websites. I want concrete information. How do you do it? You know, to the degree that you can reveal it, of course. But a lot of times, what's least useful to me is a website that describes it in marketing terms. I mean, obviously, that's what you want to put as your face to the outside world. But if you have a press section, that press section should have white papers, should have factual material. I always want to know, well, how do you do it? And that gives me the chance to report to my audience, you know, more clearly what's going on behind the scenes here. That's what I want to know.
What do you think of some of the companies that are podcasting out of their press rooms?
Some of them are doing a good job, some of them not. What I'd love to hear more of, and I don't hear enough of, is the engineers. You know, make it a Skunkworks project. Make it, give them some freedom, some leeway. At least give it the appearance of some freedom and leeway to tell the truth, to talk about it, to talk about the negatives as well as the positives. The more honest, the whole notion of podcasting, I think, and the reason podcasting succeeds is it's anti-corporate, it's anti-slick, it's honest, it's authentic. If you do a corporate podcast that is not that, you're just not going to have the audience. But on the other hand, there's an opportunity. If you do a podcast like that, I think you're going to win a lot of fans.
Are there any corporate podcasts in particular that you think are good examples for others to follow?
Not yet.
Did you hear Cisco's? Have you heard Cisco's new podcast?
You know, I've heard about it. I haven't heard it, so I'll hold off.
Or IBM, rather?
IBM. I actually talked with an engineer at IBM and encouraged him and told him what I just said here, but I haven't heard the result of it. But I think IBM is certainly gets it. The problem is, you know, you've always got to get by the corporate gatekeepers, and a lot of them are very nervous. You know, what's happening here is that there's a struggle for control, not just inside companies, but in general. A struggle for control between consumers and corporate interests. You know, you're seeing that with copy protection, a struggle for honesty versus spin within the corporation. And the old guard is not letting go easily. We're in a new world now where it's really important that you speak authentically and honestly and tell the truth. Consumers expect that, and they value it, and they will reward that. And they're really fed up and done with, I think, the same old corporate cliches.
You know, it's easy to say, you know, not let's not have spin, let's just have the facts. But, I mean, if we look just at how politically divided this country is right now, half the country has one set of beliefs, and those are their truths. The other half of the country has another set of beliefs, those are their truths. So where is the truth? I mean, isn't truth in and of itself subjective? Isn't the quest for objectivity nothing more than, in fact, a quest?
I agree with you 100%. And so that's the point of view. I mean, this is, if you're going to express it, there's a difference between spin and your subjective truth. Spin is a manipulation. Spin is trying to get somebody else to buy something, to buy into your story. That's not how to do it. Tell your story. Be authentic. Tell your subjective truth. Yeah, we all have different truths. That's the nature of humanity. But what you should be doing instead of trying to manipulate is tell your truth.
Well,
and
unfortunately,
let the listener decide.
From our point of view, from the PR point of view, you know, we're dealing with the media, in many cases the mainstream media, with very short attention spans, and
yes,
they're looking for ratings, and they're looking for viewers, and they're looking for circulation, and they're looking for sensationalism. And in many cases, our job is to make sure that our clients are represented fairly by the media.
Yeah, I agree with you.
In the precious seconds that they have.
That's a very good role. That's not spinning. That's saying, look, tell the truth. And it is very unfortunate that, you know, this happens. I agree with you 100%. I think the media definitely does that. I do that. We all do that because it's more fun to tell a story with some zing to it than the actual facts. And
I mean, unfortunately, when you've only got 10 seconds for a soundbite,
right,
you need to pick the truth that that's going to resonate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the American public increasingly has pretty sophisticated BS detectors. They're pretty sophisticated about manipulation.
I agree.
So I agree that you probably, you know, it's okay to pursue an agenda. I'm not saying don't pursue an agenda. That's not what I mean. I just mean don't manipulate, don't BS. You know, you can pursue your agenda, but pursue it with truth. And I think it will carry more weight in the long run.
I don't think there's any good PR professional who would knowingly BS and set their client up to deliver on false expectations.
No, I agree. Although, I mean, remember, that's what marketing, to some degree, that's what marketing is. The reason people have such sophisticated BS and detectors is because we're inundated with it. We have been our entire lives. Ring around the collar to whiter whites and brighter brights. And we are now very hyper aware of that and expect more, and I think reasonably.
It's a very good point. I mean, we're seeing now in popular television shows like Entourage. I don't know if you've ever watched that. It's an HBO program that's quite popular. I mean, the publicist now is a recurring role.
Interesting.
What's going on behind the scenes is a recurring role.
Is the publicist played as a hero or a villain?
You know, the publicist usually is played as a villain, historically.
Right.
In this particular program, I would say there's a little more dimension, but not much.
Well, I would say, why are publicists usually played as villains? Because that role is perceived as somebody who will lie to you for their own gain. And so that's where publicists really have an opportunity. I mean, gosh, when publicists are honest and straightforward, and there are quite a few, by the way. I deal with PR professionals who are that way all the time. I think that's probably the majority now.
Well, the argument could also be made that those who are misunderstood are often misrepresented.
Yes. Well, yeah, you've got to be clear.
And the fact of the matter is, my father still doesn't really know what I do. He's still asking, what is it you do?
I think it's probably a good idea to redefine, for your own satisfaction, if nothing else, to redefine your job as a person who, you know, you're a journalist of a sort. You're a journalist for a particular company and representing a particular truth, but make sure it's the truth, you know, and I think that that's an honorable role, frankly.
And that's an excellent segue, because podcasting, as I see it, gives organizations the opportunity to communicate directly with their constituents insofar as they can do so in a way that is interesting and compelling.
Yes, interesting, compelling, and authentic and honest. I agree with you. And by the way, authenticity and honesty are surprisingly compelling.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to speak with us.
Oh, my pleasure. It's very provocative, really interesting stuff that, you know, I don't think enough about. I think it's very important. So I'm glad you called.
You've been listening to On the Record Online with Eric Schwartzman, where reporters and journalists go on the record about how they use the web to cover the news. For the latest trends, tips, and tactics on how the web impacts corporate reputations, subscribe to our RSS news feed or visit us online at www.ipressroom.com.